Well, good morning. I'd like to take a quick survey this morning as everybody's getting all set and prepared for the sermon here. Where are we from? Where did you travel to or travel from to arrive here? So I'd like, if you would, raise your hand if you traveled here from locations that are outside the United States. We have two. Any others? I met some folks, said they were from Canada. There we go. Oh, there you are. Hi. Raise your hand if you traveled here from locations in the United States that are west of the Mississippi River. There we go. Now we're getting a few more. How about east of the Mississippi River, but you've never had Mr. McCoy as your pastor? There. We're getting more and more local. Lots more people are showing. And finally, all of those that have had Mr. McCoy as your pastor. Yeah, we wanted to be here with him. Absolutely did. Well, while this is a very brief kind of a survey, it does show that we come from many, many different locations, and we have many different backgrounds. I'm sure it wouldn't surprise you too much to realize that these unique locations can also have some cultural aspects, some communication aspects. I often wondered if we got somebody from South Boston and put them in a room with somebody from South Georgia, if they would need an interpreter to be able to communicate. I live in the Philadelphia area, but I'm not originally from Philadelphia. I'm originally from the southwest corner of Minnesota near Iowa and South Dakota. Lots of relatives from Sioux City, Iowa, and from that other place. You get up here and it goes, whoop, it's gone. Now, I may live in New Jersey now, which is about 10 miles from the heart of Philly, but my heart is still in the Midwest. I brought all that with me. I mean, our family just moved here back in 1969. I mean, they can't get rid of that quickly. But what a cultural change it was for a boy in an elementary school in Minnesota to move to New Jersey. If you've ever moved a significant distance to a new location in your lifetime, you might be able to recall similar circumstances. I don't know if you'd ever heard of this, or maybe you've seen it as well. I have. But about 38% of all retirees move to a new location when they retire. How many move back? In preparing this, I read about a couple that moved back to Duluth because they just didn't fit well in Florida. And it was all their friends and all their family that they needed to be around. We do identify where we came from. It is a part of our diversity. But another aspect of our lives that helps to identify us is based on our skills, the gifts that we've been given by our Father to do things. My brother and sister both are quite artistic. My brother always worked with his hands, and in high school, he got very involved in all the pottery making, and our home was filled with one hanging pot after another because he also got involved in macrame. My sister could paint. My father had set her up with all of his photographs that he took while he was overseas in the military, all stationed in Europe, and he picked out certain pictures. She got with the art director at school and had her own class of one, where over the year, she painted all of those pictures, and our home was filled with them. She got an A. I can draw a stick figure. It isn't very good. But I can also create databases, and I understand computers and networking, firewalls, system building. I'm an IT guy. My brother, believe it or not, went on to become a ship fitter welder. My sister went on to one of the most important jobs in the whole wide world, the most important manager we all know, our mom. Who we are and where we come from all help to create our persona, our character, our personalities. We're individuals, aren't we? We're an incredibly diverse group of people, and yet we're all here today. And it's because of one miraculous event that we're brought here, and that's God's calling. It's the only reason we're all here. Under no other circumstance that I can imagine would all of us be here in this room, considering our backgrounds and our skills. I'd like you to see this from a different perspective, though. Turn with me to John 10. John 10, we're going to start in verse 23. I want us to see this from Jesus Christ's perspective more than anything else. John 10, verse 23, and Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. The Jews surrounded him and said to him, "How long do you keep us in doubt? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly." Jesus answered them, "I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. But you do not believe, because you are not of my sheep, as I said. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall anyone snatch them out of my hand. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. I and my Father are one." I and my Father are one. And this one is literally one. It's the Hebrew word heis, H-E-I-S. Jesus Christ and the Father are one. The same mind, the same spirit. They are in total agreement. And as Jesus was preparing himself for his ultimate betrayal and his arrest in Gethsemane, he prayed to the Father, and that prayer was documented in John 17. Let's go there and see something very important. You see, he knew what was about to happen to him. Yet in this very heartfelt prayer in John 17, his thoughts and his concerns were turned toward all of us. Let's begin in verse 20, John 17, verse 20. "I do not pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word." Make no mistake about it. As Jesus Christ was preparing himself to be arrested, preparing himself for his last hours of this life, his focus was on every single person in this room today. In verse 21, "that they all may be one. As you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me. And the glory which you gave me, I have given them, that they may be one, just as we are one. I in them, and you in me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them as you have loved me." It is Jesus Christ's desire that we become one with him and with the Father. Just as they are one, we're to become one with them. The very time that we're celebrating, the Feast of Tabernacles, focuses on a time when we will be part of the fulfillment of this prayer. We will be one with Jesus Christ and one with God the Father. And that's so exciting to think that. We're finally going to have that understanding. We're finally going to have that peace. We just got done discussing how great our diversity is, or how great our diversity can be at the extremes. How then do we become one mind with Jesus Christ? Brethren, do you see that we're going to become one with each other? All one. How do we do that? How do we make that happen? The one I'm closest to in my life is my wife. And I can assure you, we are not one. Indeed, we've often said that we're a good match for each other because we complement each other so well. But we're not one. Ask her how she feels about the dirty clothes I leave on the floor at times. You know, I tell her, I was going to get them. I just need a few minutes. And that's why I'm so glad that I'm an IT guy, because I have Wi-Fi in the doghouse. So, brethren, how do we become one with God? Well, never fear. Our Bible's here. And it will help. We have some wonderful example in these pages to begin to show us that very issue. Let's begin in Genesis 12 and verse 1. This is such a wonderful process that we get a chance to witness. And we know these scriptures were put there for us. We can learn so much by going through what happened thousands and thousands of years ago. It's all very, very relevant to us today. Genesis 12, and we'll begin in verse 1. Now the Lord had said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you." He didn't even know where he was going. "I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all of the families of the earth shall be blessed." When God says that to you, how can you not be excited? Genesis 12, verse 4. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. 75 years old, time for an adventure. I'm 64 and I'm thinking, oh, I only have a little more to go. 75 years old and he goes out on the adventure of a life. But it is the same for us, isn't it? God called us and opened our eyes to the Sabbath day. And we responded. We trusted God. And then, because we trusted him first, he trusted us with more information, more truth. We're responsible for what we learn, right? God taught us about the holy days. And guess what happened? Well, as wonderfully diverse as we all are, I look out now. What do I see? One, a room filled with people who are here for one purpose, to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. We are one. And it came through obedience. We are now one mind with Jesus Christ and God the Father. Keep the feast. Yes, sir. So it starts for us too, based on obedience. Now, before we move on, I want you to notice an underlying theme in all that we're going to see with Abram, who becomes Abraham. Notice verse 2 and verse 3. God is telling Abram here that he has plans for him. He tells him what he wants to do, to make a great nation from him. And Abram responded in faith, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Does it say anywhere that from that point forward, Abram lived a perfect life, a sinless life? Was Abram's faith unfaltering? It doesn't say that because it wouldn't be true. You can read the rest of Genesis 12. You'll find that Abram did indeed have trouble trusting God on a few occasions. Instead, he chose to rely on his own wits, and he created a deception rather than fully trusting God. He reacted similarly in Genesis 20, talking about his wife as his sister. We'll get to Genesis 20 in a little while. How many times do we do likewise? Deciding how we're going to resolve a difficult situation that we find ourselves in, rather than relying on God. But Abram continued to grow, and he indeed was mentored by God. Genesis 13, we see how Abram dealt very fairly with Lot in separating their business. And he had quite a business. Let's turn to Genesis 15. And begin in verse 3. Speaking to God, he says, Abram said, "Look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir." And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir." Then he brought him outside and said, "Look now toward heaven, and count the stars if you're able to number them." And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." And he believed in the Lord, and he accounted it to him for righteousness. This specific issue, "Where is my heir?" comes up throughout Abram's life. He has no heir, but God has a plan. Abram has considered that plan, but he can't see. He can't see how it will work. He does trust God, but maybe not yet, not that far. But even though he does trust him, what he does trust him for is accounted to him for righteousness, because he stepped out in faith. Similarly, we all learn through our obedience to step out in faith. You remember the first time you ever had a choice, pay the bill or pay your tithe, and you paid the tithe, and all of a sudden the bill got paid for? Just like that. I can't snap my fingers. And our faith grows. So after all of this, is Abram 100% now? No. Are we? No. We're learning. We're growing. A quick read of Genesis 16 will show that between him and his wife, they thought it might be a good idea to come up with a backup plan, an alternative way to meet what God has promised. Sarai gave her maid Hagar to Abram, and Hagar bore him a son named Ishmael. Abram is still struggling with his inability to see the solutions, when the only real solution he has requires faith alone. By the time we get to Genesis 17, it has been 13 years since Abram had last a conversation with God. Let's go to Genesis 17 and verse 1. Genesis 17 and verse 1, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless. And I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. Then Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. 99 years old. Then God explains his plan for Abram in more detail. And note in verse 4 what it says. You shall be a father of many nations. Abram has had this promise for 24 years. Each time God speaks to him, it grows in scope and size and promise. He learns more and more of the details. And yet, to this point in time, it is unfulfilled. Drop down to verse 21. Genesis 17, verse 21. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. These words, set time, are the same words used to indicate an appointed time, a specific appointed time. The Hebrew word is moed, M-O-A-D-E. It's also the same word used to indicate a season or a fast. 24 years, God knew exactly when Sarah should become pregnant. It was part of the plan. In Genesis 18, God seemingly tests the compassion that Abraham has for all the righteous that may be in Sodom and Gomorrah. He allows Abraham to question him over and over regarding those in the city that may be righteous. I'd encourage you to read through that, noting that God knows exactly how many righteous there are in both cities the entire time. But he's learning about Abraham's heart. The angels that go into the city are simply confirming that everything that they've been told is true. Notice verse 10 in Genesis 18. And he said, I will certainly return to you according to the time of life. And behold, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. Sarah was listening in the tent door, which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age, and Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. She had apparently gone through menopause. And God repeats this confirmation in verse 10, referencing at the time of life. Throughout his life, God has been there with Abraham. He's worked with him. He's listened to him, tested him, watched him, blessed him abundantly. God worked with Abraham one-on-one. And in that time, Abraham grew, learning the lesson that God prepared for him. And all our days, God works with us as well. If you ask any speaker here, you will find out very quickly. I didn't write that sermon. I didn't write that sermonette. I know what I sat down to write, but what came out of the pen is not what I put down. God inspires these words. These are his messages to you. They're not ours. God works with every one of us, no matter who you are. Finally, in Genesis 21, after 25 years, Abraham and Sarah are blessed with Isaac. And while his faith and obedience enabled this to occur, meaning that lack of faith and lack of obedience could have prevented it, this was God keeping a promise. Isaac's birth was a kept promise and the fulfillment of prophecy. Abraham was much more important than he had ever realized. Genesis 21:1, and the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken, for Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time, of which God had spoken to him. As we begin in Genesis 22, we do not know for a fact how old Isaac has become. Commentators vary on the ages, but most, if not all, agree that he was not a boy of any age. In fact, most believe that he was between 20 and 25 years old, some saying that it could be as high as 33 or 36 years old. 36 is probably the upper limit. However old Isaac actually is, add that to Abraham's age of 100. As we begin this chapter, Genesis 22, consider Abraham now being at a minimum 120 years old. Verse 1, now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. He's still testing him. And he said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. Then he said, take now your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. This would have to be the hardest thing in the world for Abraham to do. Throughout his first 75 years of life, he was heirless. No son, no offspring, no understanding of what was in store for him, trying to come up with ways that he could have an heir that would be acceptable to everyone. And then he was told that he would have an offspring. And in fact, that they would be as numerous as the stars over time. How can this happen if Isaac is now to be sacrificed? He didn't know. He didn't know. Verse 3. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac, his son. And he split the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. There was no argument. There was obedience. There was faith. I really struggle with the very idea of human sacrifice being discussed in the Bible. Actually, attributing my own ignorance to why it is here to begin with. What didn't I know that could explain why would God ask him to do this? All these years, and he finally has his son, a son he loves so very much. Why would God ask him to sacrifice his son? Surely God knows what Isaac means to Abraham. And what of all the promises? 25 years of promise. How could there be a nation and a blessing to all of the people of the entire earth, the entire world, if there was no Isaac? Surely nothing would require more faith than to trust God at this very time. Your faith must be complete, knowing that God is a truly righteous God and worthy of that faith. Abraham had that faith in God. Genesis 22, verse 9. Then they came to the place of which God had told him. And Abraham built an altar there. He placed the wood in order, and he bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched his hand out and took the knife to slay his son. In all of this, we do not see any struggle, any rebellion from Isaac. Did he know why he was going there? He trusted his father. Verse 11, but the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. So he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son, his only begotten son, if that is what God asked for. If that was what was needed to make God's plan go forward. He did not understand how it would all be resolved. And that willingness to sacrifice his son, his only begotten son, enabled Abraham to see exactly what our father faced. John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. At that point in time, and like no other person ever before, Abraham and God were one. They were one. Verse 15, then the angel of the Lord called Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. The day is coming, brethren, when we will no longer be that IT guy or that guy from Jersey or from Minnesota. We will have a great deal more in common than we ever had separating us. We will become one with each other, one with God the Father and our elder brother, Jesus Christ. That opportunity lays before us, and we know that it comes through obedience and faith, and hopefully, each and every one here will hear those words. Now I know.